Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz interview series with filmmaker Christian St. Clair. He produced and directed an illuminating documentary called This is Gary McFarland. He was the influential composer, arranger, vibraphonist, and vocalist that left an incredible mark on the world of jazz and music overall. He collaborated with some of the finest names in jazz and had one incredible decade from 1960 to 1970, a prolific creation, and left us at the age of 38 after ingesting methadone while having a drink in a New York City bar. Christian has a lot of fresh insights into Gary, his music, making the film, and why this musician is so important for people to hear about and know. Dig it, my friends.
First of all, hey, thanks for taking a little time to speak with me about your film. I really appreciate
absolutely.
It.
Yeah, absolutely. No problem.
You know, what I find one of the coolest things about guys like you and filmmakers kind of with the whole vein of searching for Sugar Man is I think you're bringing a really good spotlight on these guys that just didn't have the full force of our PR machine these days, and more people should have known about Gary, that's for sure.
Absolutely, yep.
So without any further ado, what I want to do is, for those that aren't in my audience of listeners that may not be familiar with Gary McFarland, and there's probably a decent amount, how would you effectively lay down a verbal synopsis of who he was?
Yeah, he was... You know, he just kind of came up through in that kind of last, you know, what I think few people have kind of referred to this last golden age of jazz, you know, sort of the late 50s into the mid to late 60s, you know, with all those studio guys like Brookmeyer, Clark Terry, you know, Jimmy Rainey, Steve Kuhn, that were all active in that time. And he quickly kind of distinguished himself as a fresh new arranger composer, kind of along the lines of Gil Evans.
Yeah.
And, you know, first writing for the Jerry Mulligan big band, which was what, you know, got him, you know, the attention of Creed Taylor at Verve Records. And then just very quickly, you know, landed some pretty choice assignments. He immediately was tapped to do sort of the jazz version of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And then he did the big band Bossa Nova record for Stan Getz, which, you know, coming on the heels of Jazz Samba was definitely, you know, a huge win for him to get that. And
sure.
And then from there, approached Bill Evans, you know, where he did one of what I think is one of his great records, special guest soloist Bill Evans. You know, all this like by like 1963 in the space of about 3 years.
Yes.
And then, you know, and then was always fascinated, not just with jazz, but with other genres of music, popular music, bossa nova, and sort of went down this more pop, jazz path, which was successful for him at a time, but I think led a lot of his original jazz people to feel like he'd kind of abandoned jazz. And unfortunately, I think that's kind of stuck through the years, and he hasn't really been given the credit he's due for all the music he created. And I think his pop jazz that was kind of derided at the time has aged very well and is also not without its rewards.
Absolutely. And as somebody that documented his existence and put so much effort into exposing who he was through a really nice mosaic of interview and footage of his life, why do you, as somebody that's bringing him to the forefront via a very well-acclaimed film, why do you think Gary is important?
I just think, you know, I can't remember if this quote is actually in the film or not, but it was Cy Johnson who said that Gary was evolutionary, not revolutionary. And I think sometimes we focus a lot on like the more revolutionary artists, and we don't give the credit due to the evolutionary artists, the artists that still very subtly sort of move the music and the art form forward. And I think he definitely did that. And I just don't think he's given the credit for that. I mean, the 60s was an incredibly, you know, just an incredible time for music. I mean, so much was exploding. We still,
you know, we're still like, you know, discovering and rediscovering and benefiting from that decade of music. And I think, you know, it's been interesting since the film has come out, because a few people, you know, have come forward saying what a huge influence Gary was on them. Like, Johnny Eccles, who was the lead guitarist in the band Love with Arthur Lee, in a review of the film in another magazine, said that they liked Gary's record Soft Samba and the In Sound so much they had it in the studio with them and were playing it when they were recording their second album.
Right on.
And Robert Lamb from Chicago listed America the Beautiful as one of his top 10 records that kind of inspired Chicago, you know. So I think a lot of musicians have been influenced by him, but, you know, just because of, he kind of died at what could be perceived as a lower point in his career. And, you know, he wasn't on a major label when he passed away. You know, a lot of the jazz gatekeepers, you know, I think still held a grudge against him for, you know, what they perceived as selling out, you know. So he just never got, you know, there was never any weight thrown against, you know, a reissue program or any attempt, you know, to put those records out. So he's just fallen through the cracks, basically.
Why don't you think at the time he sold better?
You mean like what? Oh, yeah, I think you mean his more pop-oriented records?
Just any of his albums. He just wasn't a big, huge seller. It wasn't something that was cerebrally right in front of the jazz audiences or the major Billboard charts, you know?
I think, you know, I think in the jazz, you know, I don't know what constituted a bestseller for jazz in the 60s. You know, certainly, like, I think the records he did with Stan Getz or, I think those sold pretty good. You know, I definitely think he was a pretty strong presence in the jazz world. I think Soft Samba sold great initially. I mean, that was the album that allowed him to actually put together a working touring group.
Yeah.
And go on a tour. But I think sort of as the decade wore on, it was kind of, there was a little bit of too little too late, you know,
yeah.
And the music was just staying so fast, you know, changing so fast. And I think being in your mid thirties in like 1967 or something like that, you know, you were kind of considered old and part of the establishment, which is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
By today's standards. But it, you know, he was just a little, you know, maybe like 3 to 5 years too old to have like really capitalized, I think, on what he was trying to do from a pop perspective.
Why do you think he was a very sought after guy? Why do you think a lot of big hitters in jazz wanted to play with him?
I think they just really liked his charts that he came up with. And he was also a very empathetic producer as well. I mean, that's another part of his, you know, talents that, I think it's kind of unrecognized a little bit, you know, like even, you know, the Gabor Szabo records that he produced for Sky just sound great, you know, like he was definitely had a great touch in the studio. And I think he was like really talented at like putting the right people together in the room and just giving them the space they need and the environment they need to create great music, you know?
Yeah.
He definitely, you know, I don't know if you read the, you know, I love that Al Kooper anecdote that I put in the front of the liner notes. I think that sums up, you know, his personality beautifully and why people, you know, wanted to work with him. And also,
absolutely,
obviously, the charts that he wrote were incredible as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So at what moment did you say, I'm going to make a film about Gary McFarlane, like the Big Bang moment? When did that happen and how did it come about?
It was probably, let's see, I started shooting it. First interview, it was probably like 99, 2000. I was out of college, majored in broadcast journalism, wanted to make a film. And that was kind of the beginning of kind of desktop filmmaking. Like you could, you know, the Canon XL1 which was one of the first like affordable consumer cameras that had the resolution of like a, you know, a professional beta camera, you know. So sure. Suddenly there were these tools that were available, you know, that weren't available, like nonlinear editing. Now you could do it on your desktop. So with that in mind, and I decided that a documentary was a film I could put together kind of with the least resources available, you know, like you could, you know, you're just shooting interviews at the beginning, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
The person I shot it with, we were, Joel Osretich, who's a co-producer and shot most of the interviews. We were just, you know, hanging out, having beers and kind of kept talking about it. And I think what really pushed me over the edge as far as doing a film about Gary was I discovered, you know, a website. Because even though I'd been collecting his records over the years, I didn't really know much about him as a person or, you know, what his story was, you know, or even if he was alive or dead, you know. And then there was this website, Doug Payne, like discography website, and it kind of had more of the story. And, you know, I had no idea about that he was, like, possibly poisoned, and so then suddenly it seemed to be, and also I was motivated by the fact that I just could not understand why this guy's music wasn't more well known and out there more. So it's kind of motivated both by, you know, some pretty compelling elements of the story, but also just appreciating his music to the point where you just kind of want to share it with the world.
So you started this process in around 99, 2000, and you start getting awards for it in 2006. Talk to me about the journey. Was there any ambiguity of finishing this, or was it always from the word go, this is a full-on thing, it's happening? And what were your expectations of how the audience was going to, you know, receive this film?
Yeah, it was, I never felt like I was going to abandon it or anything like that. It was, you know, it's a long process. Learning a lot of things as you go along. It played at some film festivals starting in like 2006. And that cut, you know, so first interviews I shot in the majority of the interviews were shot between 2000 and 2004. And then, you know, kind of off and on editing for about a year and a half, 2 years. And then I was never fully satisfied with the edit I had put together that played at the film festivals. And even though, you know, the film was well received and people liked it, you know, no one really came forward wanting to distribute it. So I just kind of like started thinking about what the next project was going to be moving forward with that. But always had it in my mind that I would revisit the film. And then I think that Fresca commercial that's in the film that he appeared in, obviously you can kind of tell there wasn't a lot of footage of Gary McFarland. There was definitely less than I was expecting to find. I mean, he was on The Tonight Show twice, but all those episodes are long gone. So,
yeah.
And so I located the Fresca commercial, which was like this neat little, like, you know, Gary McFarland video practically.
Yeah.
And Coca-Cola just wouldn't license it to me.
Wow.
And so it wasn't in the cut that screened at film festivals, but I didn't want to release it without that piece of footage because it, with so little footage of Gary and with that footage, I think being as cool and compelling as it was, I just need to be in there. Plus the story around it was great.
Yeah.
So I kind of like, you know, job circumstances changed, making a little more money. I realized, you know, I can probably afford to put this thing out myself, pay the music clearances. Universal was very cooperative on that. So I went back, revisited the Fresca commercial, finally was able to persuade them to license it to me. And then once I had that, I kind of went back with the editor I'm working with on my current film, and we kind of did a re-edit, incorporated that footage, redid all the motion graphics. And then another thing I felt was lacking was kind of I just wanted to put in more action shots of Gary McFarlane kind of in the act of making music.
Yeah.
Whether it was playing the vibes or conducting or what have you. So layer in all those things. And then was actually close to putting it out, you know, in like 2 years ago. And then just through a chance, reading an article in the Seattle Times, there was an article about Jim Wilkie, the NPR DJ who hosted Jazz After Hours, and made mention of the fact that he had all these reel-to-reel tapes of artists that had played at Seattle's big jazz club in the 60s called the Penthouse. And I knew Gary McFarland had played there in 65, so I reached out to him. And sure enough, he had two reels. And so then I kind of had to go back, get all the clearances for that, you know, contact all the surviving participants, get their sign off, and, you know, remaster that. And then once it kind of became in the CD DVD package, I had friends at Light in the Attic and they agreed to distribute it. So that's kind of the long journey to official release.
Yeah. Long winding road. Yeah. Let me ask you this about Gary. What's happened in the afterglow of this film? Has there been people that have reached out to you and had more interest? Has his album sales gone up? What's kind of been the afterglow of your film?
That's kind of still to be determined. I think it's, you know, Downbeat gave it 4.5 stars, which was wonderful to see. I mean,
yeah.
I think that's probably, that's been great, you know, and it's been nice to see a lot of like more pop oriented magazines kind of pick it up, like Mojo magazine or Shindig. It's, you know, it's been great. It's gotten consistently good reviews, which, you know, when you've kind of lived with a project for so long, you kind of lose objective perspective, you know, whether is this good or bad, you know. So it's just been really nice to see, I think, people connecting to the story and the music on a very kind of emotional level, I think, which is, you know, very gratifying. And like I said, like, you know, there's been little revelations of these musicians that have like, oh, yeah, well, of course we were influenced by Gary, you know. And that's been great to see.
You know, the interesting thing about Gary is that he kind of fits within this bio, this jazz bio of a lot of these guys that have weird deaths that are mysterious. Like, you know, did Chet Baker really just fall off the ledge? There was another guy where his wife apparently walked in and gunned him down. Like, when you get to that.
Lee Morgan.
Yes, Lee Morgan. So when you get to that point in your life where things are spinning kind of in that Laura Palmer kind of lynchish kind of a thing. What do you think happened that day? Personally, as someone that's delved into this, because you hear Frank.
It's really, I mean, it's, I don't know. I mean, it's so, what's crazy is the fact that it's common knowledge that he died of a methadone overdose, regardless of whether he took it knowingly or it was a prank. And that there was no investigation or paper trail. Like, there was no report filed. And so regardless of the question, did he know it or didn't he, you know, there was definitely a cover-up, you know. So, and I think, you know, that was probably orchestrated out of business needs by, you know, the bar owner, because, you know, the cops were always kind of shaking down these club owners and would have used that as an excuse to kind of, you know, shut the place down. So he kind of had to orchestrate some kind of cover up, you know, whether that was paying off cops not to look into it further or what. But I mean, the death certificate has him like dying of a fatty liver, which is just totally ridiculous.
Yes.
You know, and it was like New York in the early 70s and 71. It was like a different, grittier place. You know, it's pre-internet, you know, stuff just, but, you know, at the same time, it was still news enough that there was, you know, a half-page obituary in the New York Times. But, yeah, it's just a mystery. It was just, you know, that someone that notable could die and everyone just kind of, oh, I guess he just died of a heart attack at 38.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without, you know, even though everyone is like, oh my gosh, he drank methadone. And, you know, there's obviously this like story spinning around that something, you know, bad happened. But there
yeah,
no...
you know, the thing that strikes me too about his death is that you would figure for an abrupt end at 38, such a big decade of creativity, his spirit would want to have the last laugh. And it seems to me that this film might be it. To resuscitate the spirit of him and get him back out there might be the last, you know, reverberating tale, so to speak, in our human dialogue of jazz and how we construct story.
I mean, I hope so. It would just be wonderful if this just led to, like, you know, more people hearing his music or people releasing his music so more people can hear his music. You know, that would be a great outcome. I mean, it's such an incredible body of work. There's really like, there's not a dog in the bunch. I mean, you may not like prefer the pop stuff versus, you know, the straight ahead jazz stuff, but there's a lot of just great music and talent, you know, running through all, you know, as a consistent thread through all these records, you know.
Yeah.
Whether it's like the Samba Strings, you know, I mean, he's doing that, but he's still like putting out the October Suite with Steve Kuhn, which is like one of the great albums of the decade. It's just a great, great body of work.
So I'm going to bring all of this to kind of a crescendo here and ask you my final question. And it's this.
Sure.
Why should the world never forget Gary McFarlane?
Well, I would just say that, you know, I think he left, and just to what I said before, he left an incredible body of work. It's just like the gift that keeps on giving. The music has not aged. It's just as fresh as it was when it was produced, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And that was just a special era of music, period. Like, just the way it was recorded, you know, the musicians, you know, the lives these musicians led that led to them being musicians, you know, it's just such a different path, you know, like being raised, you know, during the Depression in rural Oregon and then, you know, discovering jazz and moving to New York. I mean, that's just, and it's just a gift, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And to have it preserved, you know, it's wonderful.
Christian, man, it was a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for putting this out there. It's great stuff, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for doing this and spreading the word. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York, Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Christian St. Clair for introducing the world to Gary McFarlane. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.